Peter B. Collins, News and Comment. It's Thursday, May 5th, 2016, Cinco de Mayo. The New York Times today published powerful graphic images of life on death row and an execution that was called off at the last minute.
This is how it ends. I feel the chemicals burn in my bloodstream. Fading out again. I feel the chemicals burn in my bloodstream.
Pop star Ed Sheeran wrote this song called Bloodstream, and I doubt that it's about the process of executing a condemned convict. But if you listen to the lyrics, it describes that very sequence. And I want to commend Patrick Chapate, or is it Chapat? He is known simply by his last name. I'll say it as Chapat. And he's an interesting guy, a Lebanese-Swiss cartoonist who was born in Karachi, Pakistan. And he has been cartooning for many years. And sometime in the recent past, he took an interest in the plight of those who live on death row and some who are ultimately executed. And in a very powerful package of multiple packages, actually, of what are called graphic journalism. These are cartoons, but they're not funny. And the images are really compelling. And I have linked to one in the show file for this podcast, which is called Memories of an Execution. And it portrays the 2004 events when, right down the road from me at San Quentin State Prison here in California, Kevin Cooper was on the gurney, was about to receive the lethal injection when the call came that the Supreme Court had put a stay on his execution. Kevin Cooper remains alive today, and he lives with the PTSD of his near-death experience. And this guy, Chapat, did an amazing job of depicting San Quentin Prison, a place that I have visited over 100 times, and the demeaning process that you go through if you visit a prisoner, particularly those who are on death row. You visit them in cages. And before you're admitted to the cage, the prisoner is brought in, shackled and handcuffed. He has to put his arms behind his back and through a portal so that the handcuffs can be removed. And then when he is seated, the visitors are allowed to enter. And the sequence here goes on to describe Kevin Cooper's event and what it was like from his perspective to wind up nearly executed, but shortly before the midnight of February 10th, 2004, about 3 hours before, the phone rang and the U.S. Supreme Court upheld his stay of execution. And I think it's a powerful sequence that many people deserve to see. And I am really I'm having trouble describing how important I think this is, and that the New York Times decided to put it as a major feature on their website today. I put in a request to interview Patrick Chapat, and I hope that comes through in the near future. Now, one of the reasons that innocent men wind up on death row for years and years, and by the way, Kevin Cooper claims innocence, and also my friend James Anderson, who has been on death row at San Quentin since 1981, he claims innocence, and I am inclined to believe him. But one of the impediments is a law that was signed by Bill Clinton in 1996, and it was called the Anti-Terrorism and Effective Death Penalty Act of 96. They seized on the tragic event in Oklahoma City, and I will just stipulate we don't know the full story of who was behind the events in Oklahoma City. It was not simply Tim McVeigh and his friend Nichols. At any rate, inside the Clinton administration, there was great debate. And I want to thank Lily Segura. It's Liliana Segura, pardon me. She is a writer for The Intercept, and this is a lengthy article. It's also linked to in the show file for this podcast. but she went to the Clinton Library and dug up the memos and documents from that period. And it shows that there was a huge debate inside the administration in particular about how to respond to Republican calls for even tougher crime laws after the 1994 crime law that Bill Clinton signed, and that was a very useful political tool for the Democrats, who are proving that they're not liberals anymore, they're not the bleeding hearts who, you know, won't execute even mentally ill people like Bill Clinton presided over on the campaign in 92. And so I really commend Segura for digging into this. And what she shows is that the Anti-Terrorism and Effective Death Penalty Act of 96 included language that sharply restricted habeas corpus rights, particularly for condemned prisoners. They thought there have been too many delays, and all we got to do is shave the rights of these people because they're all guilty anyway. We know that. And it'll speed up the executions, and that will make the death penalty more effective. That was their argument. And I am pleased to see from Segura's reporting that Abner Mikva, who I knew as a congressman from Chicago, I met him in the 1970s. He later became a federal judge. Then he retired and he served as an advisor in the Clinton administration. And he was the strongest voice opposing the attempt to rewrite the laws of habeas corpus in the mid-90s. And one of the major political actors who pushed through the Republicans' favored language about habeas corpus was Ron Klain. He was chief of staff at the time to Attorney General Janet Reno, later chief of staff to Joe Biden as vice president. And I think this is an important story, and this is the one that so far the Clintons have not backpedaled on or been asked to explain or apologize for. And it's time that somebody asks them those questions. Well, there is some remorse that is showing up among Republicans now that it's clear that Donald Trump will be the standard bearer for the party this year. And over at The Guardian, Dan Roberts and Ben Jacobs wrote it up as the five stages of grief. And they basically put George W. Bush and his dad into the denial category. President George W. Bush does not plan to participate in or comment on the presidential campaign. That was the terse statement issued from his office the other day. Then there's Nebraska Senator Ben Sasse, who is moving on to the next stage, voicing anger. He said, why are we confined to these two terrible choices? This is America. If both choices stink, we reject them and go bigger. That's what we do. Others in Congress appear ready for bargaining, another phase in grief. As the presumptive nominee, Trump now has the opportunity and the obligation to unite our party around our goals, said Mitch McConnell, the Senate Majority Leader. And then some people sink into depression. The Wall Street Journal, lamenting, Trump may be able to improve his image if he controls his perpetual insult machine, but there is little evidence that he can or will do so. The essence of his politics is personal, and it's not obvious he knows any other way. His trade policies are certainly opposed by the Wall Street Journal and Rupert Murdoch. They're reckless and would either be rebuffed by the world or lead to a global recession. And, continuing on this grief theme, after denial, anger, bargaining, and depression ought to come a final stage known as acceptance. But psychologists warn that reaching this stage of mourning is a gift not afforded to everyone. And I heard Rush Limbaugh in a particularly sad mood today. Yesterday he was buoyant and, you know, Trump is going to change the party, fix the party, fix the country. And today he was kind of in his cups, explaining to his listeners that the reason he doesn't endorse in primaries is that people can let him down. And what triggered this is the news that Trump is softening his opposition to any increase in the minimum wage. And that's smart politics. And we're going to have to expect that Trump will never be consistent in his positions. And this is just the latest example of that. Then there's Kelly Ayotte of New Hampshire. She's in a tough re-election race. She is saying that she will support Trump, but she will not endorse him. What the fuck does that mean? Peter King, the loudmouth from Long Island, a Republican, he echoed other Republicans in saying he'll vote for Trump even though he has reservations, saying that Trump is a guy with no knowledge of what's going on. And he went on, as far as any involvement or campaigning, it's really going to depend on him filling in the gaps and consolidating his policies. Right now, there is no real coherence. Then there are Hispanic Latino Republicans, like South Florida Congressman Carlos Curbelo, who said that his voters resent Trump for his inflammatory language. He said resentment is a kind way of saying it. People are offended and really incredulous. And then there's Bill Kristol, not to be confused with Billy Kristol, the comedian. Bill Kristol's the editor of the Weekly Standard, and he was early in his opposition to Trump, and now he's kind of stuck with it. And he punts to, I think people are underestimating the degree to which you could see a crisis in the Republican Party. I think you're in one, Bill. And in fact, you may be witnessing the death throes of the modern Republican Party. Jonathan Turley posted a couple of days ago. He is the law professor from George Washington University. And he responded to a comment that Bill Clinton made on the campaign trail, comparing the Hillary email investigations into a speeding ticket. And this is a bizarre way that he put it. He said, if you're driving in a 50-mile-an-hour zone and a cop pulls you over when you're driving 40 and says, I'm sorry, I have to give you a ticket because you know the speed limit here should be 35 and you should have known it. Now, that is a bizarre little story to tell. And then he said that this is just a game. Well, Turley responds pretty harshly. He said it repeats what is manifestly incorrect reading of the controlling law. And Turley admits that he has his own top secret clearance. He's had it since the Reagan era due to his national security work. And so he personally is quite well versed on the rules of what is considered classified and what isn't. And he said, you do not generate material as the Secretary of State and assume that it is unclassified. You're supposed to assume and treat it as presumptively classified. So he considers them to be careless, and I'll use the word arrogant, even though he doesn't. I infer that from his comments. He says it would be premature to dismiss or predict an indictment, and it is certainly not a game. But in terms of legal strategy, Clinton's comments, that's Bill, would make most criminal defense attorneys wince. There is clearly a huge investigation at the FBI, including the granting of immunity to a prior aide of Clinton. And that brings us back to this continuing narrative of the Clintons and supporters in belittling the investigation and its underlying issues. I'm quoting from Turley now. What Clinton did, at minimum, was reckless and entirely dismissive of national security interests. To put such secrets at risk for mere convenience or a desire to control your emails only magnifies the lack of judgment. And he says this may work well as a stump speech, but it is truly a horrible legal position. And so there are two active fronts. The FBI is continuing an investigation. They submitted a secret document in a court briefing to prevent Jason Leopold from accessing more emails under the Freedom of Information Act because of their ongoing investigation. And yesterday we told you the state of the lawsuit brought by Judicial Watch, which also is at the stage of depositions, and the judge made it clear that Hillary may have to submit to one of those depositions. So it is not a trivial matter. It is not a closed case, no matter what the Clinton spin doctors try to tell you. The Intercept is doing some great investigative reporting. And the latest is a deeper look at the FBI's use of Stingray cell phone trackers. And I credit Jenna McLaughlin, the reporter on this story. And I have to guess that she is working with Trevor Aronson, who has been on top of these issues of stingrays for a long time. And what they are noting is that we had guessed in the past that the FBI would let a local law enforcement agency use a stingray to identify a suspect and then not use the evidence from the stingray in the court proceedings and instead use what's called parallel construction. Because once you know what you're able to prove through the stingray, you can find other ways to gather evidence to prove that. Well, now the FBI has made the blunder of putting that advice into a memo. It was sent to the Oklahoma City Police Department's chief, Bill City, and the response from the American Civil Liberties Union is pretty strong. This is the first time I've seen language this explicit in an FBI nondisclosure agreement, says Nate Wessler, staff attorney, ACLU. The typical NDAs order local police to hide information from courts and defense attorneys, which is bad enough. But this goes the outrageous extra step of ordering police to actually engage in evidence laundering. And instead of just hiding the surveillance, the FBI is mandating manufacture of a whole new chain of evidence to throw defense attorneys and judges off the scent. So this is an egregious violation of constitutional rights, left and right. And of course, the FBI is above the law, and we shouldn't ask questions because they're keeping America safe. Every day I like to pause for a second and thank the people who support my work here at the Peter B. Collins Podcast with your subscriptions. People like Don Sisney, who kicks in $10 a month. Justin Keene, I believe he's now living in New Zealand. He just renewed his annual subscription. Casey Condon, Julie Dupree, they both kick in $10 a month too, and I'm very grateful. I'd like you to join their ranks. It's easy. Come on over to peterbcollins.com. You click on the menu button, then the pull-down menu. You click on Become a Subscriber. And on that page, you can choose $5, $10, $20 a month. The $50 annual subscription comes with your bonus book, and you can see the bonus books displayed on the subscriber page at peterbcollins.com. Well, California Governor Jerry Brown just signed into law a series of bills that raise the age to purchase tobacco from 18 to 21. And the related bills also equate smokeless vape devices, the e-cigarettes, to tobacco products. And while I recognize the huge toll that tobacco takes, over 400,000 Americans die every year from tobacco use. My concern is that this is just another form of prohibition. And prohibition doesn't work with pot. Prohibition doesn't work with tobacco. Now, trying to keep tobacco products out of the hands of teenagers is a worthwhile goal. And we've done a lot to try to educate young people and many other methods. But I frankly disagree with my good friend State Senator Mark Leno, who carried this bill and considers it a huge victory for public health in California. And curiously, Governor Brown vetoed one of the package of bills that would have allowed local government to put tobacco tax increases on a local ballot. And my reason is that over the last few years, we've ratcheted up the tax on tobacco products in California, and it has led to a measurable decrease in consumption of tobacco products. And by increasing the price of cigarettes, it makes it harder for a teenager on a limited budget to buy them. I think it's more effective than prohibition. But that is the choice that the governor made. Meanwhile, the feds at the FDA, the Food and Drug Administration, have made final their sweeping new rules that extend federal regulatory authority to e-cigarettes. With a 500-page roadmap published, they announced that they ban the sale of e-cigarettes to Americans under 18. There are currently about 9 million adult e-cig users in the United States. And frankly, both at the California level and the FDA, I haven't seen enough evidence to suggest that e-cigarettes are as dangerous as traditional paper cigarettes. And I know many people who have been able to wean themselves off the cigarettes sold by the big tobacco companies by using what they call vaping. I've been around people who use these electronic smoking devices, and I don't find it annoying, not nearly as annoying as cigarette smoke. And so I think that this is premature to lump together a new delivery system that allows people to avoid taking in the nicotine that is the carcinogen that cigarettes deliver. So I understand the motivation, but I don't quite support the policies that are being adopted here. President Obama went to Flint, Michigan yesterday, and I'm pretty disappointed with what he did there. Apparently, on the way from the airport to Flint, he called Governor Rick Snyder and urged him to go speak to the crowd before Obama did. Snyder complied. He went to the podium where he tried to talk through a chorus of boos in the room. And the president, I think, tried to shift the focus in ways that are completely insulting to the people of Flint. He, for a photo op, said this isn't a stunt, and he doesn't like to do stunts, but in front of the rolling cameras, he picked up a glass of water and took the smallest possible sip from it. So the photo op shows him holding the glass, not attempting to drink it. And he said, look, the water is safe. This came out of a tap with a filter. Well, that wasn't a very persuasive performance. I mean, if he had slugged back a glass of water, it would have been much more compelling and convincing. So then he kind of gave the people of Flint, who he described as a feisty crowd, a pep talk about government. He said, this myth that government is always the enemy that forgets that our government is us. It's us. That's it. An extension of us, ourselves. That attitude is as corrosive to our democracy as the stuff that resulted in lead in your water, because what happens is it leads to systematic neglect. It leads to carelessness and callousness. Now, this is a total misreading of what happened in Flint. Callousness, yes. It wasn't carelessness. This was a power grab by the governor of Michigan, Rick Snyder. He appointed the emergency manager who reported directly to him, who made the decision to switch from the Detroit Water System's safe product to the toxic water from the Flint River that then caused the corroded lead pipes to cough up their lead and put it into the water. And Rick Snyder is directly responsible for this, not some myth that government is the enemy. Now, Snyder's a businessman who said that he was going to run Michigan government like a business. And so maybe this is an indirect swipe at him. But I wanted to hear Obama really slam Rick Snyder and his emergency governance policies and strategies and demand his resignation. But Obama did nothing of the sort, and the little pep talk he gave to the people of Flint, if you've ever been there, and I have, you will see how tragic Flint is as one of the areas of the United States that has just been written off. And Michael Moore, who came to fame because of Roger and Me, the movie about Flint that was destroyed after General Motors pulled out its manufacturing plant, Michael Moore spoke up, and on Facebook he called out President Obama. Quote, you say you're coming to listen to the people of Flint? Sir, they've been poisoned for 2 damn years. You've known about it since October. There is nothing to listen to. Unless you're bringing the entire U.S. Army Corps of Engineers to dig up and replace the 75,000 lead pipes, plus the Attorney General to arrest Rick Snyder, the governor, then this is just another photo op and half-baked list of new promises we don't need. Michael Moore said on MSNBC that Obama's speech was an example of this attitude of not pushing too hard. Don't say out loud what needs to be said. He said it's a poor city, but he's not saying it's a black city. The governor removed the black mayors, put in his own cronies, gave the rich a $1 billion tax cut, and then had to cut back on services because there wasn't enough money. One of the services they cut back on was clean drinking water. Well, Michael Moore is telling it like it is. And frankly, Obama should be ashamed for his performance in Flint. There's an ugly new law that takes effect next week in the state of Utah. Republican lawmakers and their governor rammed through this law in March, which is unscientific, and it is extremely confusing. It requires women who seek an abortion at 20 weeks or later to first be given anesthesia or painkillers. And the drugs are not intended for them, but for the fetus. Now think about this. The fetus is part of the mother. And in order to give it an anesthetic before the abortion can be performed, you essentially have to knock out the mom. And the extent to which the anesthesia actually reaches the fetus before the procedure is somewhat hard to calculate. So abortion rights activists and some obstetricians say the law is bafflingly vague, scientifically unsound. It intrudes into confidential decisions between doctors and patients. It can put women's health at risk by creating a broad requirement for them to take unspecified painkillers. Here is Dr. Leah Torres, obstetrician gynecologist in Salt Lake City. You're asking me to invent a procedure that doesn't have any research to back it up. You want me to experiment on my patients. This is another trap law. Targeted regulations against abortion providers. And this is driven by the most extreme views in American politics today. They're looking for any pretext to push a case up to the Supreme Court, hoping that without an Obama appointee, that the next court will ban abortion. And they're trying to create the legal path for that to occur. And this is just, it's astounding. It really is. And another abortion-related case, a female doctor in Washington, D.C., Diane Horvath Cosper, is an obstetrician and gynecologist, and she has spoken up publicly in support of abortion rights because she says the dialogue is dominated by those who have demonized this totally normal part of healthcare. I don't think the way to deal with bullies is to cower and pull back. But she has filed a legal complaint against the hospital where she works because they've told her to shut up. They were nicer than that, probably. But after the Colorado Springs killing last November, Robert Deere is the suspect there who was just declared incompetent to stand trial. Well, the hospital administrator told her to go silent. And they didn't want to put a blue light special on the fact that we provide abortions at MedStar Hospital. And since then, they've ordered her to turn down several requests for interviews or articles or risk losing her job. So what is rich here is that her lawyers are citing the Church Amendment, which was originally adopted to protect people who had a religious objection to abortions, medical doctors and others. But the law states that no entity receiving federal money may discriminate against any doctor because of his or her religious beliefs or moral convictions respecting sterilization procedures, or abortion. So they're using a law that was passed by anti-abortion activists to protect the rights of a pro-abortion doctor who wants her First Amendment rights back. I think that's nice. Now, many of these same lawmakers who thunder about the value of life and the need to protect a fetus also oppose any reasonable gun law changes that would restrict access or put on trigger locks. And this has tragic results for toddlers. And if we want to protect the sanctity of life, doesn't it matter after birth too? Well, today in the New York Times, they profile the cases of four toddlers who shot and killed themselves in a single week last month. Plus, the mom, who was driving through Milwaukee, who was killed after her two-year-old picked up a gun that had slid out from under the driver's seat. I'm going to link to this story in the show file for this podcast. I encourage you to read it. Because we're in this strange era in America where too many people believe that the best way to address gun violence is more guns. And to avoid any restrictions that could protect children from the guns of their parents is just so absolutely reckless that it's amazing that these people can live with themselves. So I encourage you to check out that story, and here is another one. We've heard from, Wayne LaPierre, Mr. NRA, the best way to deal with a bad guy with a gun is a good guy with a gun. Well, that axiom, if that's what it could be called, was disproven the other day in Arlington, Texas. That's outside Dallas. Now, the good guy with a gun was a fitness coach who saw a scene. He saw a gunman fire at a woman outside the shopping mall where the fitness center and a Walgreens drugstore are located. So he went to his car, grabbed a handgun, and confronted the shooter. and the shooter shot and killed this good guy with a gun. The shooter is an Army private, Ricky Braddon, age 22. He went to the drugstore where his wife worked. He took her out to the parking lot. They had a fight. He pulled a gun. He shot at her twice, at her feet, apparently. And that's when Anthony Lee Antel, age 35, saw the scene, went into the crossbar, actually went to his car outside the CrossFit abattoir, and confronted the gunman, who then shot and killed him. So think carefully about this stuff, because we are fed so much irrational thinking, so many Orwellian ideas, and the NRA does it on a daily basis. And we close today with a little music from Prince. The song is Sometimes It Snows in April. Prince died on my birthday, April 21st, so I'll never forget that. And we're now learning, through an unusual channel, that Prince was addicted to opioid painkillers. Percocet, apparently, was the drug. And he had reached out for help. He had associates contact Dr. Howard Kornfeld, whose office is just a few miles from me here in Marin County, California. Kornfeld is a nationally known specialist, helping people beat opioid addiction. And when he heard from Prince's associates, he dispatched his son, who's a medical student, to go visit Paisley Park. And the younger Kornfeld was actually there when they went looking for Prince and discovered him dead in the elevator at his home and studio at Paisley Park. And as I've said before, I hope that the love that people have for Prince will help us overcome the demonization of people who become hooked on painkillers, and that we can intervene before more people who get cut off of their prescription painkillers turn to heroin, which is a very common process that's occurring these days. Thanks, Prince. And I hope that your death is going to help many other people confront these problems that really have raged out of control in recent years in this country. I'm Peter B. Collins. Thanks for joining me today for my news and comment podcast.